there's so many different possibilities that can go wrong in a kitchen. You could stick milking spoons into fleshing pots, spoons into milking pots. They could be binyomo, they could be ena binyomo, they could be shishim, no shishim, not sure the shishim, every possibility out there. So we have to try to familiarize ourselves, not that we're necessarily going to talk about every single situation, but at least familiarize ourselves with what the basic klolim are, what the issues are, what, how to identify what shayla to ask, and very important to be able to know what information to give the Rav in order to be able to try to answer the question properly. So let's backpedal a little bit, just look at the ABCs of all the shaylas are really ultimately boiled down to, if I'm intending, boiled down to two gemaras. One of the gemaras that we spoke about last week, Kederish, Shabisha, Babasa, Levasha, Vacholov. If you have a fleshy pot, so then you're not allowed to use that pot to cook milk in. Then Bisha, Benesin, Dam. And if you went ahead and you did it, so then the resulting food may become treif. It depends if there's taste or not. So if you have a pot full of milk, and I'm trying to figure out whether it's Basa, Vacholov, so you have to taste it. Someone's got to taste it. Forget who the person's going to be. Someone's going to taste it and tell you, can you discern a little bit of the meaty taste, the residue, whatever's left inside the walls of the pot, then it would pose a problem. If it passes the taste test, then it would be permissible. So that's one Gemara that's critical for our discussion. And there's another Gemara, it's actually a Mishnah, and Dafkuk Chesem, a Sechus Chulin, Tipas Cholosh Nafal Alachaticha. But if you have a drop of milk that falls off the piece of meat, so Harezeb and Benaisin Tam. So also the same idea, that the way to know whether the piece of meat is kosher is going to depend upon, is there nice and dam, is there taste? So it's clear from both of these Gemaras that taste is the critical component in our entire discussion. The presence is going to cause a problem, the absence is going to be permissible. But there's a big problem, because how in the world would we know that there's a taste? That's something that we mentioned at the end of the show last week. We're not going to taste it, because if we taste it and we end up tasting it, then we just violated the Isra of eating Basa B'chol. So obviously we're going to have a non-Jew taste it for us, which opened up for Machlokes, Rashi, and Tosfos as to how that works. And Rashi was of the opinion that the non-Jew is basically a Siach L'fi Tumo, that we don't make him think he's doing anything too serious, we just kind of get him casually to schmooze, and we trust the Siach L'fi Tumo for some reason, even though the Gemara seems to say in other contexts, we're not so comfortable with that, but somehow this is good enough to rely on the Siach L'fi Tumo. And Tosfos says that's not always going on. Tosfos says you have to get the professional, you got to get the super-duper expert, and get him to put his reputation on the line, and then and only then can you trust him. So it's this Machlokes, like Rashi, and Tosfos that set the stage for the following phenomena. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Chulin that what if I have a mixture, whether Basa B'chol, like we're talking about, or perhaps other kinds of Tarovasim, and there's no going around. I can't find the going. I can't find the manager. So what do? So the Gemara says, very simple, we have an alternate test. The alternate test is the magic number shishim. If you have 60 times of component A to component B, now in the case of Basa B'chol, so let's say I have a big pot of meat soup and I have a little drop of milk, so then if I have shishim to the meat corresponding to a little bit of the milk, or let's say I have a big pot of kosher soup and a drop of chaza falls in, if I have shishim corresponding to the little drop of treifas, so that's going to be okay. Why is that going to be okay? So the Gemara tells us that the Chachamim determined that it's highly unlikely that if there's shishim there, that there's going to be a taste. So shishim is not really the halacha. Shishim, the poshim shah in the Gemara is that shishim is not really a halacha. Moshe was seen that literally babish that it's ashir shishim. Shishim is a way that shiru Chachamim, the Chachamim determined that it's most probably okay. We can be comfortable enough to say that it's probably the taste is going to be no longer present. That's a simple reading of the Gemara. It's because of this almost like substitute. The real halacha is really no sintam. The emphasis is really getting going to taste it. But if for whatever reason you can, so then shishim is kind of like the b'diav, kind of like the backup plan two, plan B. Because shishim is not absolutely perfect, that's why the Rishonim explained to us, let's say I go ahead and I rely on bitul b'shishim, and I taste it, and by golly, I taste it. Shishim will taste it tomorrow, but the mice can still taste the treifas. So then the halacha is that I can't eat it. That would be a problem, because shishim is not an absolute. Shishim is a most probably. Shishim, it's a rove. It's enough of a rove that the chum are comfortable with giving you the opportunity to eat it. But if and when you actually taste it, so that is a problem. As a further machlokes acharonim, to what degree is that a problem? Is that a problem deraisa? Is that a problem derabbanan? A lot of people say that's a problem deraisa. If at the end of the day you taste it, the shishim day tomorrow, if this particular food, sometimes it's hard to know, sometimes the food is a little bit sharper, the other food is a little bit blander, it's not always so simple to tell. So it could be that if you really taste it, you may have a deraisa problem on your hand. So shishim is not the end all. On the other hand, shishim very often is an exaggeration. Mar says that Most foods by don't even need shishim. Very often it's enough with less than shishim. But it's hard to know, it's hard to tell. So therefore Chazal made almost like a cutoff point, shishim, even though shishim is probably more on the side of erring and caution than an absolute number. So the number shishim is there, it's in the bar, it's in Shulchan Aruch, but it's not an absolute perfect number, and it's not really the optimal number. They're not really the way you're supposed to go. You're really supposed to have a non-Jew taste. That would be a much more accurate way of knowing, tachas lemaisa, is there a problem here or not? So the Ramah quotes a custom that we have already for many, many years that we don't do to imas goy anymore. That we don't rely on the goyim to taste, even though the Gemara says beferish you're allowed to. And therefore, by default, says the Ramah, whenever you have a shiloh, whether it's bas mechala, whether it's other things, the rabbi doesn't start bringing in goyim to taste. If somebody comes and says, Rabbi, a little bit of milk fell into my pot, or my milk spoon went into my chicken soup, the rabbi doesn't start looking around for Julio to start tasting the chicken soup. We just go for the magic number shishim. What changed? The Gemara says that shishim is plan B. Why in today's world did it become plan A? So Rabbi Kivega suggests that maybe the reason why the shift was because it was unclear how Te'imas Goy works. We mentioned a moment ago that according to Rashi, the way you're allowed to believe the non-Jew is because he's just kind of schmoozing with you, which is very casually, Masech HaVitumo. Whereas according to Tosfos, it's the exact opposite. It's because we're so serious that we put him in the corner, we say, your reputation rests on this, your ability to be a professional cook is going to depend on the answer you're going to give. So we scare him, make him realize the severity, the seriousness of the question. So Kivega says those two approaches are mutually exclusive. They're contradictory. Because what are we supposed to say to the non-Jew? So it was supposed to be kind of shooting the breeze with the non-Jew and to fulfill Rashi Shita. Then you don't have Tosis's understanding of Uman Lamar Nafshe, because if he doesn't think it's serious, then he's not going to feel that his reputation is on the line. If we're going to make it very, very serious, that's going to detract from Rashi's pshat of Masechta Bituma. So it's impossible to get Rashi and Tosis. The only way to get Rashi and Tosis outside Nuchamra, two guys, Brisketer, be two guys. One guy, one guy is a regular guy sitting schmoozing on the street, and he's the Rashi guy. Then the other guy's got the big white chef, Julia. Julia Child, she's the one who's wearing, I don't know if she wears the hat also, but somebody wears, Mr. Child wears the hat, and he gives the real professional assessment. Two going already, it's hard enough to find one going. So Kivega says that's ridiculous already. So therefore the meaning became that, forget about it, we just go through plan B. Plan B is easier, it works. It's not perfect, because when you do plan B, you're always opening yourself up for that possibility that you may be very sadly disappointed to find that it actually does taste. Or you may end up once in a while throwing out food unnecessarily because it probably doesn't have a time, but what you do? Lays braver. Yes, sir.
So essentially, we're relying on the non-Jew to determine the halachic status of the...
That's right. So that's based on either the idea that we assume the non-Jew's probably telling us the truth because he has nothing to gain by lying, or because he's a professional, he's not going to ruin his reputation.
Right, but we talked before, I think you once gave an example where Dorit showed up at somewhere, Richard sourced for donuts, and I think you said, like, well, if the non-Jew said that they came from the grocery store, you wouldn't necessarily believe them.
Right, very good, right, excellent. Right, so the answer is that it depends whether the non-Jew has something to lose or not. So if the non-Jew is very casually speaking, and there's nothing to be gained whatsoever, so that's much more of a reason to assume he's telling the truth. But here, that particular case, they're referring to the case of the professor. So the professor said to us, the professor wants us to eat those donuts. He knows that we want them to be kosher. So that's why he went supposedly to the kosher store. That, at least that's what he's claiming. So he has an incentive to tell us that those donuts are kosher. So that's really where it gets tricky. That we assume the basic starting point of all humanity is everybody's truthful until they have a potential reason to tell us something that's not true. Now, when we have a Jew who's Shomer Torah mitzvos, so then there's a rule called Erechen and Misurin. So we assume, I'm allowed to eat in your house, we're allowed to eat in his house, we're allowed to trust the Shochet, because everybody's from, everyone's taking this seriously. But the non-Jew, Kashrus doesn't mean anything to him. So then when he tells you something is kosher and he has something potentially to lose, let's say the non-Jewish store owner tells you that the food is kosher. So, maybe he's saying it for business reasons, maybe he's doing it for other incentives, so that wouldn't work in halacha. So the bottom line is that everything translates to the magic word shishim today. So no one's asking the goyim anymore today. The bottom line is we're all working with the number shishim. So now we have to fine-tune a little bit what exactly that means, how exactly you go about determining shishim. So shishim is, of course, a very, very difficult thing to determine. So let's say, we'll give a classic example. I stick my milchik spoon into my pot of soup. So technically speaking, the question that I really have to ask myself is there shishim in the milchiks corresponding to the soup? How in the world am I going to know the answer to that question? Because what I don't know is how much bleeds, how much taste is actually absorbed into the walls of that spoon. Now, I know that I used that spoon an hour ago to stir some hot milk. So the halacha of kasher and kalim, Sukkim and Bashas Matos, teach me that some of the taste of that milk went into the walls of the spoon. That's the whole reason why you have to kasher things in the first place. So the assumption is that when I have a milchik spoon, I have a whole bunch of tipas chalavs inside that spoon. I have a lot of milk that's inside that spoon. I have no idea how much milk went into that spoon. I have no idea how much milk came out of that spoon when I put it into the pot of the chicken soup. So I have a lot of sphakis. Unfortunately, that's not a sphakis. I have a lot of sphakis. I have a lot of doubt. I have no idea whether the shishim or not. So what do we do with that? So the Gemara has a discussion about that. The Gemara in the seventh paragraph of Sefer Chulin discusses not spoons into chicken soup. The Gemara has a little bit of a different discussion. Probably not the most common shav that we would ever have. And that's what's called the kchal. A kchal is an udder of an animal. Now, if you think about it, an udder of an animal is a very, very strange thing because it's almost like a built-in bas b'cholov. There's milk and there's meat. And if you cook it together, then you may have a problem. So that's an entire sugya in the seventh parak of Sefer Chulin, a whole complicated sugya in Shulchan Aruch about the intricacies of the chus kchal. In many yeshivas, when they learn for smicha, so they skip the entire sugya of kchal. Because at the end of the day, it's not so relevant, and Chazal made a whole bunch of gezeimers on kchal, and it's also anyway, but there's a lot of razzle-dazzle along this. So the difficult gulim that I gave you a day in yeshiva, so the first time around, I actually gave a couple of shiurim on kchal, and by the second time around, I think they took it off the smicha requirement, or I decided to take it off my smicha bechina, so it became by default off the smicha requirement. So lemaisa, I think the bachim were proficient in chal. So if you still have smicha from before 1995, I don't know what it says on it, bachim will call it chal. It's a very, very, very technical, intricate part of your idea. Anyway, so the bottom line is that the Gemara in the discussion, in discussing chal, so the Gemara has a comment that when a chal falls into, let's say, a big pot of meat, cooking a big pot of cholent, and somebody drops an udder into that pot of cholent, so you're trying to figure out how much milk came out of the udder, because if X amount came out, then it's going to be multiple shishim, yeah, no. So the Gemara says, lo yadina kama nafik binei. The Gemara says, we have no idea. There's no ruach kodesh. The Gemara says, how much milk came out of the udder, actually. So what do you do when you have a suffix? So the Gemara says, v'sharina mekulek chal. So you have to be mishayer, you have to evaluate the entire volume of the chal itself. So if the chal itself can, let's see, a little water displacement, a little eureka here, okay? So Archimedes' principles, you have to figure out how much liquid could possibly be in this chal. So the answer is, there can't be more liquid in the chal than the total volume of the chal itself. But we have no idea where the cutoff point is, so therefore you have to mishayer connect the entire chal. So the bottom line is that the chal could let's say displace 3 ounces of water, so you have to have 60 times that 3 ounces, you have to 180 ounces of cholent in order to be mafter the subsequent tarevus. So that's a cloud that appears in the Gemara. That since you don't know, so mamele you have to be machmir. So the Rishonim are quick to point out that, why do you have to be machmir exactly? What you don't know, why don't we call it a suffik and say, suffik derban lakula. That's suffik derban lakula, this is bas b'cholof. Yeah, but this is chal, the whole din of Chalav chal is all through Rabban anyway, but the rice and none of this is really considered halachically to be milk. Any milk that didn't come out, b'chai ha-behemah, didn't come out, wasn't milked yet, technically the rice is not really considered to be milk. So the whole issue of chal is only through Rabban anyway. Why don't you say, sveikah through Rabban l'kula? Why does it want to turn the tables on us and say, you have to be machmir? Why can't I say, I'll make an approximate number, take a guess, and call it a day. So the Rishonim explained you can't do that. So different Rishonim explain slightly different nuances why you can't do that. But the basic thing boils down to the Rashba has a lashon, imkei masar te Torah l'cholach v'yechad. It's a strange thing, this kind of a suffix. I'm going to say my chal had this amount, and you're going to say chal had that amount, and yet I'm going to say shema, everyone's going to say the wrong thing. That you can't have halacha working like that. So yef shel shayer like that. So therefore, Chazal, almost like as a blanket statement, had to say, everyone has to earn the sword of caution. So whatever the reason for this halach is, the bottom line, that's what it says in Shulchan Aruch and Yerodea, that when you have these kinds of sphakis, how much milk came out of the chal, you have to take the worst possible number. So the Rishonim quote that the same is true when you have a spoon that goes into a pot of soup. So I'm cooking a pot of chicken soup, and I stick my milchik spoon in. I just used the spoon to stir hot milchik an hour ago. I stick it into my pot of chicken soup. Nobody has ruach hakodesh to tell me how much milk just came out of this. I have absolutely no idea. Do I have shishim in the pot connected? I do not know. The only thing I do know is that if there's shishim in the pot connected the entire spoon, then for sure I don't have a problem because it is physically impossible. I don't know much about physics. But it is physically, we had a fellow we had to be, you know, so there was someone here for Shabbos who was staying with us. Sakhi father, he wasn't, he's also left with us a little bit, but there was a fellow who was here. So he was, he has some very, very advanced degrees in physics and math and something. So we were trying to make casual, trying to be safe with Duma, make some casual conversation. So he was kind of explained to us what he does. I couldn't get past the first sentence. I didn't know what he was talking about. Everyone was just sitting around the table and nod. It sounds smart. I mean, well, he could have told me equals MC cubed, and I would have said, that sounds great. But he seemed to know what he was talking about. Anyway, so the bottom line physics is that it is impossible for there to be more milk in the spoon than there is spoon proper. So if the entire volume of the spoon can only displace X amount of water, so then if you have 60 times X, the math, 60X, so then you know for a fact that you're going to have a sheishim. But even that's not 100% simple how to calculate. So these are some of the questions that the Rav has to ask. So you stuck your milchik spoon into your pot of a chicken soup. And even though it's chicken, and remember chicken is only the Rabbanan, but we can't be mekel, because remember chal is also only the Rabbanan. So we have to earn the sign of caution. So you need sheishim keneged the entire spoon. What does that mean? Keneged what part of the spoon? The handle of the spoon? The part of the spoon that didn't go into the pot, that's nowhere near where the tarobus is, that's a big machlekes rishayim. So many rishayim, probably most rishayim say, when we say you need shishim, can I get the entire spoon? It doesn't mean literally the entire spoon. What if I have a 4-foot ladle? You don't need shishim, can I get that part of the ladle? You need shishim, can I get the part that went into the pot? So if I have a milchik spoon that went into a fleshy pot, a chicken soup, I have to be careful to remember, I have to look carefully and see before. Usually what happens is there's like a scream from the kitchen when that happens. But try to calm, keep your wits with you, and try to look how much of the spoon went in. Probably it's already out, and your wife already took it out and threw it on the floor or something, and now sends you off to the rub. So try to see if you can figure out approximately how much of that spoon actually went in. That's the cooler version. That's the lenient version. So Rabbeinu Peretz, one of the Gedolei Rishonim, said, no, not so simple. Rabbeinu Peretz said, if it's a metal spoon, then all bets are off. Why? Because metal, we have the following, there's a physics principle. Cham mitzoso, cham kulo. That when it comes to metal, so metal conducts heat. So even if a small part of the spoon is inside the chicken soup, that heat spread all the way up to the top. And then by doing so, it spread all the way back to the bottom as well. And all the bleas, those bleas of milk that we have no idea how much they are, that have now inside the walls of this spoon are now coming out and shooting around in all directions because of that principle called Cham Mitzoso Cham Kulo. So it says Rabbeinu Peretz, if it's a plastic spoon, perhaps never so plastic, but if it would be a wooden spoon, a plastic spoon, something like that, so then Rabbeinu Peretz would say, then you only have to mishai, you only have to calculate corresponding to the amount that went into the food itself. But if it's metal, then all bets are off. Cham Mitzoso Cham Kulo. How did Rabbeinu Peretz know Cham Mitzoso Cham Kulo? He didn't know from the chem lab. How did he know such a concept? It's a Gemara. Gemara in the 7th parak of Pesachim. The Gemara talks about the Korban Pesach. That's what the Sugya appears when you roast the Korban Pesach. So you have to be careful what kind of a spit that you use. We need some barbecue experts over here. So you can't use a metal spit to stick into the Korban Pesach, because what's going to happen is that the whole metal is going to get hot, and then the heat of the metal is going to be, any part of the Korban Pesach that touches the heat of the metal is going to become roasted, going to become cooked up from the heat of the metal rather than the heat of the flame. And the Torah says it's liesh, it has to be a direct hit, it's got to be the fire's got to touch the food. It can't be that it's getting it through some conduit or something else. So you have to use a shvil shorimo, you have to use a wooden kind of a spit rather than a metal spit. So the Gemara says, the Pharaoh says, Dirb Chamit Tesu Cham Kulo. So then a parrot said, it says heat there, it says heat there, just as by Korban Pesach, there's a din of Chamit Tesu Cham Kulo, so too by blias, by things falling into pots, if it's metals, then everything changes. That was the famous Pesach of Rabbeinu Peretz. So do we accept this Rabbeinu Peretz or not? So most of Rishonim probably disagreed. So most of Rishonim argued that just because something gets hot doesn't necessarily mean that the bleas are spread. It gets complicated, where the heat may be able to work one direction, maybe it doesn't draw something out from the top of the spoon. It gets very complicated. Therefore, the shot gets complicated. Most Rishonim probably hold that we don't really, really accept this. So this gets a little bit tricky. Sometimes you have a small spoon, it's probably not that much of a difference anyway, because it's always hard to know how far the spoon went in altogether. You have a big, big ladle, so then it may be a big difference. But many of the ladles are plastic anyway, so you wouldn't have to be chayshish. So there are different opinions in the later poskim about to what degree we do or do not accept the bitter parents. Every once in a while, I have experienced the chamik tzos chamik kulo, when something was in the fire or something, and I touched it, and I thought it was like 6 feet away, it wasn't going to be hot. At that point, always I thank the bitter parents for that klala of chamik tzas chamik kula, but it really exists. Whether it impacts it or was kashrus is a different question, but the mitzias definitely does exist. So we seem to have a little bit of the ABCs as to what to do. So I have my milchik spoon, and I stick it into my pot of a chicken soup, and then I realize what I did. So it sounds like I'm going to have a problem. That, again, depending on how I'm going to calculate the bliyas, what's fakes, what's nice, what's chamik tzasos, but at the end of the day, it's going to be a problem. Well, not so simple that it's going to be a problem. What exactly is the degree of heat, halakhic heat, of this item that I'm consuming bleeds? The Gemara tells us what's called tzonein b'tzonein b'hadocha, that if you have two things that are cold, so then there are no bleeds whatsoever, just simply have to be washed off. So if I take a piece of chazer, and I put a cold piece of chazer down on my plate, so absolutely nothing happens to my plate. I just have to wash it off, make sure there's no chazer residue on it. Then it's butl chadchila 10 minutes later, I can use that plate. Tzonein b'tzonein b'hadocha. So obviously heat is necessary in order for bleeds, for tasting, for changing of absorption of things to occur. The question is, what kind of heat is necessary? So this was a major, major machlokes in Rishonim, which has very, very real nafkamins levir in our kitchens today. And so there was one group of Rishonim who said that the definition of heat that's necessary to create any problems in your day whatsoever is whatever heat the Torah and the Halacha recognize that can create bishul. Because bishul, that's the ultimate process that involves heat. So anything that is hot enough to cook is hot enough to have bliyas. Anything that halachically is not hot enough to cook is not hot enough to make bliyas. So that is a tremendous kula, because what that means is, we know it's a very, very famous Gemara, Masech Shabbos, in the third prayer, that says, unequivocally, kli sheni eino mevasha. The kli sheni does not have the ability to affect bishul. Therefore, if you just learned the third prayer of Masech Shabbos, you would walk away with the conclusion that I have a piping hot cup of water. Just was poured out of out of the tea kettle. I deliberately left out an urn because urns are a little bit more complicated. Let's take the old stuff tea kettle. I take a chinek and I pour the water into a cup. And according to the simple meaning of the Gemara and Shabbos, I can do whatever. I can take a raw piece of chicken and cook it there if it'll work. I can do whatever I want. Kli sheni ain't enough. Kli sheni does absolutely zero, nothing, any shape or form of dish. That's the simple meaning of the Gemara. Now, that's assuming that Masechta Shabbos ends on Nachmem. When you keep on going for another 100 blot or so, then you realize that it's not always 100% true, because there is a Mishnah tucked away at the end of Masechta Shabbos, the magic words called Kali Habishol, things that are very, very easily cooked, very soft, you know, fine kinds of foods that can easily cook. So the Mishnah says all bets are off, but those kinds of foods can, in fact, not that permissible, I'm saying they can, and therefore usher, there's usher to cook those things in a klisheni. Klisheni has enough heat to it to affect bishul on lower level kinds of things. So it's probably not going to do bishul on a piece of chicken, but it may do bishul on some very, very small, tender kind of a food. So that's limitation number one of klisheni. Limitation number two of klisheni is that Tosfos points out in the third Pesach of Shabbos that it would appear in between the lines. You have to read the lines carefully, but Tosfos, at least some Rishonim, Tosfos quotes a read that says that although min haTorah klisheni and mevashel, but min derabbanan klisheni is mevashel, is a problem. It's a mechzek kibishul. It looks, gives off the impression a little bit like cooking. And if you see a guy putting raw food into a klisheni, that doesn't look too good on Shabbos. And therefore, midirabanan, that would pose a problem. So when all the dust settles between those two sugyas that we just mentioned, number one, the kali habishul issue. And number two, the potential is a derabanan. Lamaisi, you're not allowed to cook in a klisheni on Shabbos. That's the achrei chlesakol. It's prohibited to cook things in a klisheni on Shabbos. One of the exceptions to the rule is, if it's what's called tavlin, if it's the spices, the Mishnah says explicitly spices are okay. So obviously spices are not considered to be kali habishul, and obviously spices somehow doesn't give off, you know, can't really see it, it's very small, it's both in the water, so it doesn't give off the idea of a mechzek b'mevashel. So the Mishnah says black and white that you're allowed to put tavlin into a klisheni. It sounds like that's for sure going to be mutter. So if you remember back to Chashabashul, we saw even that's not so simple. That was the big machlokes with Chaim and others about making tea on Shabbos. So Chaim Brisker was of the opinion, it's mutlach et chilu to make tea Why don't you take a tea bag and put it into a cliche? As long as the water came out of the tea kettle, it's a cliche. It's piping hot. You can put the tea bag in. It's at the gomor. It's a cliche. Cliche. And Mabashal tea is like tablin in the end of the story. So the Mishnah Bura, Rav Moshe, and others disagreed with that psach from Chaim. They held no, the tavlin of Chazal is not the same tavlin we have today. Shlomo Zalman explained that the tavlin in the old days was like was a big piece of cinnamon, a big piece of ginger, a big thick thing. So a big thick kind of a food is not kalei bishul, it's hard to cook. It's like a big piece of chicken, a big piece of meat. Whereas a little teeny weeny, you know, cut up into little tiny pieces of tea leaf today, for sure it can become cooked in a cliche. Half the time you make tea in a cliche on Tuesday, you don't even realize it. If you take water out of the tea, out of the urn, pour it into your cup, and then stick your tea bag in, you just make tea in a cliche, and you drink tea in a cliche. Nobody thinks, oh, this tea doesn't taste so good because it's only cliche tea. Of course, tea is able to be made in a cliche. So this was a big machlokes in Paiskim about are you allowed to make tea under what circumstances, cliche, cliche, etc. But that's the Chashavas part of the story. So how does this all play out in terms of Chas Kashrus? So some Rishonim say that whatever can't affect Bishul in Hilchos Shabbos cannot affect Bliyos in Hilchos Kashrus. And the Ika Mikra did Klishen is Edim Avashu. The Chumbers, the Rabbanans, and the Cheshash of Kalei Bishul, all that stuff probably doesn't carry over Hilchos Kashrus for whatever reason. And therefore, Lemaisa, half the Rishonim said, any problem that occurs in a Klisheni, you can totally and completely ignore. There's no Bliyos, there's no problem whatsoever. So if you think for a moment, the ramifications of that are as follows. How many times have the following happened in your house? Sitting down with a good hot cup of coffee, and you put your milk into your good cup of coffee, and you're stirring, or about to stir your whatever you're going to put into your coffee, and you know, you're not paying too much careful attention, and you go over to the sink, you grab a fleishig spoon, and you start stirring your hot coffee with the milk, and then your wife comes in and starts screaming at you. So what happened exactly? How bad did you just trafe up that spoon? How bad did you trafe up the mug? What exactly happened? So according to Hefter Rishonim, nothing happened. Absolutely nothing happened. You know why? Because your cup of coffee is a cliche and you're ready. Unless you're drinking your coffee out of an urn, I don't think you're doing that. So by the time you're drinking the coffee, it's already at least a cliche. If you're drinking the Dunkin' Donuts coffee, it's already at least a cliche. So it's way beyond the scope of any bliyas to be concerned of. So according to one whole group of Rishonim, there's nothing to worry about. Everything is mutter. Just tzonin b'tzonin v'hadocha. It's 180 degrees, but he didn't start, so just wash everything off and everything's good to go. That's what one opinion of Rishayim is. The other group of Rishayim say that equation between Bishul and Bliyas is absolutely incorrect. That Bishul Luchud, Bliyas Luchud. That just because something cannot affect the Bishul has absolutely zero bearings on whether it can affect Bliyas. So if that's the case, then it doesn't matter whether it's halachli Mivashel or not. So how do we paskin the halacha and the shaila? So there are different opinions in the later poskim, the Taz, the Shach, and the poskim, and Shulchan Aruch, how we should be noyeg. Basically, what we try to do is as follows. We try to avoid the school. If we don't have to rely on the school, we try to avoid the school. Therefore, things that are easily kasherable under these circumstances, we'll kasher them. So the more correct thing to do is, when you stuck your fleshy spoon into the coffee mug, the more correct thing to do is to kasher the spoon. Put the spoon aside and then figure out how to kasher the spoon a little bit later. We'll have it sit around until our Pesach, like all the other trefa spoons, and then try to figure out what to do then, and then forget it, and then have to put it off till next year. I have like two different piles in my house. I have all the utensils that were supposed to be kashered 6 years ago on Pesach that just keep on growing, and I have all of last year's lulavim and 6 years ago's lulavim that I can never find. It's all the same thing every year of Pesach. I said, mad rush to try to find it. It's a half a lulav leaf or something to throw into the Bir Chametz. I can never find it. So I now, the last couple of years, I now take, I don't leave my whole lulav. I'm snagging, it's enough, a half a leaf. So I take a half a leaf and I put it by the Pesach dishes. So that way, when I unpack the Pesach dishes, then I have a fighting chance of finding that lulav. And even then, half the time, I forget to bring it. I'm halfway to Riverdale for Bir Chametz, for Michal Chametz, and I remember that I left this. I have two piles in my basement. My sukkah things for Pesach, my Pesach things for sukkah. Sure. Anyway, so since it's so easy to cash in the spoon, the person says it's preferable to cash in the spoon. It's better. Why should you rely on a plate, a shiloh in the kitchen? Better cash in the spoon. Now it becomes a little trickier. The mug usually can't be kasher. Mugs are usually ceramic or something, things that are not neat them to be kashered. So that's a little bit of a problem. So the Poskim write, if it's a Hefsed Meruba, you're allowed to rely on the Mekilim, Hefsed Mua. How much is Hefsed Meruba? I mean, I have some coffee mug today. I guess it depends. It's like that special coffee mug that they bought you for your 30th birthday with your picture on it. You know, like, they're coffee mugs, they're coffee mugs. You know, so every person has to use their judgment in terms of, you know, how, what's considered to be Hefsed Meruba or not. I remember the Poskim point out in Yerodea that the term Hefsed Meruba changes for different people. What's Hefsed Meruba for Reuven may not be for Shimon. I remember there was a fellow once who called me. I don't want to pry into his personal business, but I happen to know that he had built himself quite a nice house for well into the seven digits. And at the time, there was some kind of a shayla, something had happened to one of his toaster oven or something. So he asked me, you know, is he mechut to throw the toaster oven out, the kashrut? So I responded, you know, the din, I would say under these circumstances, if it's a Hefsed Meruba, one has the right to be mekel. I said with a little bit of a smile, you know, I don't want to point out, you know, maybe for a coal couple of heights, a toaster oven has some room, but it didn't seem to fit his general financial standings. So again, each person is a little bit different in this matter. So the bottom line is all these kinds of cliche shilas, whatever can be avoided, can be cashed in, if it's something insignificant to throw out, why don't you try to do that? If it's something that becomes a little bit more needy, so then you should consult with the Rav and try to figure out that we have a little bit of right to be more makeup. Very often there are other start of Mahaka, we'll talk next week a little bit about the Ben Yomos, that someone's going to change a lot of the factors on the table. But the basic rule is that when there's heat, there's problems. If heat is defined by Bishul, then there's significantly less problems.
So you said the urn is different, like I guess an Istahat, but also, you know, the thing about your sink.
Okay, we're going to get to all those things. We're going to get to all those things about Klirishas, Klishen, where did you draw the line? So even in Tumtzalam, there's such a distinction between Klirishas and Klishen. If you go down the root of the Mekilim, then it becomes very, very important for us to quickly review what's a Kli Rishon, what's a Kli Sheni.
On those first postgame, would you be allowed to drink with us the coffee?
It's the same shadow. I mean, it would be the same shadow. According to those who say that nothing happened and the coffee is also mutter. According to those who say something did happen, then I would say to throw the coffee to a coffee. Unless maybe there was shishim connected to the spoon that went in. That would be what we said before. So again, if you go down the route that Bli is Luchur and Bishul Luchur, the two are not really interconnected, then it's always nice to chaz the Hilchot Kli Rishon, but it's not really relevant for this. But if you go down the first route, which b'di'evah, you know, Makom Hefsed, we tend to rely on, so it is important just to very, very quickly familiarize ourselves again. We spent a lot of time over the years, especially in the Chashavashim, going through the details, we're not going to talk too much about that. But suffice it to say that in order to be a klisheni, this is going to sound like a very profound statement, in order to be a klisheni, it has to be a klisheni. I mean, you have to make sure that you really have a klisheni. Not everything that resembles cliché is necessarily cliché. So one of the pivotal issues is what's called iroi. When I pour something out of a klirishon and it hasn't yet landed in the klisheni, is that considered to be klirishon? Is that considered to be cliché? That was a major machlokes 3 days in Tosfos where the answer to that question is. So we most probably paskin in the middle ground. Let's go to the Rashi with the klipa that. Bishul, the klisheni, I'm sorry, iroi, going into a klisheni, has the ability to cook a little bit. For that reason, that one should not take a tea kettle and pour it over tea bags. To do that, with the most of the poskim, that's a very, very serious problem. To take a tea kettle, take an urn, and pour it directly onto the tea bag, that's a very, very big problem. If the water goes into the cup first, and then you throw the tea bag in, then we can negotiate. Then Reb Chaim will help you. Then we can discuss the shayla. But to pour hot water directly onto a tea bag, according to Rov Rishonim, that's an isavishal deraisa. The Rashbam disagreed. I don't think the Rashbam drank tea. None of the Rishonim drank tea because tea didn't make its way to Europe till a little bit later. But if the Rashbam would have had tea, so then he would have made tea. Just take literally hot water from a chaynik and pour it onto a tea bag. But the Rov Rishonim didn't accept that. So even if you want to be makil, that klisheni is enem avashal, and therefore klisheni is enem avliya, you have to make sure that you have a real klisheni. In addition, there's a whole other dimension of klisheni. Klisheni, that's called a gush. A gush means like a thick piece of food, like a solid piece of food. So there was a famous chumra of the Maharshal that whenever you have a dava gush, so the game is over, that retains its status of klisheni on the oil of oil. So let's say I have a hot piece of a chicken, I take it out of the pan and in the oven, and I put it down on my plate. So that's vita considered to be Kli Rishon. Then I move it to another plate. It's on the sixth plate already, but it's still steaming hot. That is still considered to be halachic like a Kli Rishon. So that makes all the difference in the world. Because let's say my wife took out the still chicken out of the oven. She put it onto a serving tray, and I took from the serving tray, I put it onto my plate, and then I go ahead to the to the kitchen, and I take out a milchik fork and a milchik knife, and I start cutting my my chicken, and then I get screamed at. So the question is, what are you screaming at me for? Cliche, it's already, the chicken's been already three times over. So the Rashal says, no, not so simple. That's not even called a cliche. The cliche means when it loses its heat because it goes from one pot to another pot to another pan to another cup to another bowl, etc. So you have what Tosis calls the Shabbos, the funnest makaros, the walls of the subsequent utensils cool down the food. When you have a solid piece of food, it retains its own heat. So it remains a kli rishon ad bias goel, or until it actually literally cools down beneath the atzel lettuce bowl. So that was the famous chum of the Maharshal. So the Ramah disagreed with that. The Ramah and the Maharshal were related to each other. So the Ramah disagreed. So they had a running back and forth correspondence about this topic. The Ramah says, L'hoyed Rami Yolim. It's also called the cliche. So one could be, you know, Shas and Chach, be a little bit on that also. So again, as the shadow starts to compound a little bit. So the case of the coffee in the cup, that's a little bit better. Not great, but a little bit better. The hot piece of chicken on the third plate already is a little bit more chomer because you have a gush against you. But there may be grounds to be made on that also. So these are where it gets very, very minor details, but they're major details because this all has to be presented to the Rav. When you ask a Shaila, it's not enough to say, we made a mistake, I goofed. I used a milchik spoon in my fleishik food. What does that mean? Did you use a milchik spoon? How big was the spoon? Was the shishim connected to the spoon? Not connected to the spoon? Was it klimisha? Was it klisheni? How hot was it? Was it irir? Was it davagush? So those are some of the things to try to focus on. Instead of just, getting panicky, just try to understand what the details are. And if you present the details properly to the Rav, so we have a better shot of trying to answer the question properly. Hopefully mention next week. We'll try to continue along some of the other things to keep in mind when asking the basic yoredation.
We're assuming that the water that comes out of the urn into the cup is a leak to
klisheni. That's assuming against the chazanish. Right? Yeah. Most disagree with that chazanish. Not everybody, but most.